John. He dreamt he was back in Winterfell, limping past the stone kings on their thrones, their grey granite eyes turned to follow him as he passed, and their grey granite fingers tightened on the hilts of the rusted swords upon their laps. "You are no Stark," he could hear them mutter, in heavy granite voices. "There is no place for you here. Go away." He walked deeper into the darkness. "Father," he called. "Bran, Rickon." No one answered. A chill wind was blowing on his neck. "Uncle," he called. "Uncle Benjen." "Father?" "Please, father, help me." Up above he heard drums. "They are feasting in the great hall, but I am not welcome there. I am no Stark, and this is not my place." His crutch slipped, and he fell to his knees. The crypts were growing darker. "A light has gone out somewhere." "Ygritte," he whispered. "Forgive me, please." But it was only a direwolf, grey and ghastly, spotted with blood, his golden eyes shining sadly through the dark. The cell was dark, the bed hard beneath him. His own bed, he remembered, his own bed in his steward's cell beneath the old bear's chambers. By rights it should have brought him sweeter dreams. Even beneath the furs he was cold. Ghost had shared his cell before the ranging, warming it against the chill of night, and in the wild Ygritte had slept beside him. Both gone now. He had burned Ygritte himself, as he knew she would have wanted. And Ghost, where are you? Was he dead as well? Was that what his dream had meant? The bloody wolf in the crypts? But the wolf in the dream had been grey, not white, grey, like Bran's wolf. Had the Thens hunted him down and killed him after Queen's Crown? If so, Bran was lost to him for good and all. John was trying to make sense of that when the horn blew. The horn of winter, he thought, still confused from sleep. But Mance never found Joramund's horn, so that couldn't be. A second blast followed, as long and deep as the first. John had to get up and go to the wall, he knew, but it was so hard. He shoved aside his furs and sat. The pain in his leg seemed duller, nothing he could not stand. He had slept in his breeches and tunic and small clothes for the added warmth, so he had only to pull on his boots and don leather and mail and cloak. The horn blew again, two long blasts, so he slung Longclaw over one shoulder, found his crutch, and hobbled down the stairs. It was the black of night outside, bitter cold and overcast. His brothers were spilling out of towers and keeps, buckling their sword belts and walking toward the wall. John looked for Pip and Gren, but could not find them. Perhaps one of them was the sentry blowing the horn. "It is Mance," he thought. "He has come at last." That was good. "We will fight a battle, and then we'll rest. Alive or dead, we'll rest." Where the stair had been, only an immense tangle of charred wood and broken ice remained below the wall. The winch raised them up now, but the cage was only big enough for 10 men at a time, and it was already on its way up by the time John arrived. He would need to wait for its return. Others waited with him. Satin, Mully, Spareboot, Kegs, big blonde Harith with his buck teeth. Everyone called him Horse. He had been a stable hand in Molestown, one of the few moles who'd stayed at Castle Black. The rest had run back to their fields and hovels, or their beds in the underground brothel. Horse wanted to take the black, though, the great buck-tooth fool. Zay remained as well, the whore who proved so handy with a crossbow. And Noy had kept 3 orphan boys whose father had died on the steps. They were young, 9 and 8 and 5, but no one else seemed to want them. As they waited for the cage to come back, Clydes brought them cups of hot mulled wine, while Three Finger Hub passed out chunks of black bread. John took a heel from him and gnawed on it. "Is it Mance Rayder?" Saturn asked anxiously. "We can hope so." There were worse things than wildlings in the dark. John remembered the words the wildling king had spoken on the Fist of the First Men as they stood amidst that pink snow. When the dead walk, walls and stakes and swords mean nothing. You cannot fight the dead, Jon Snow. No man knows that half so well as me. Just thinking of it made the wind seem a little colder. Finally, the cage came clanking back down, swaying at the end of the long chain, and they crowded in silently and shut the door. Mully yanked the bell rope 3 times. A moment later, they began to rise, by fits and starts at first, then more smoothly. No one spoke. At the top, the cage swung sideways, and they clambered out one by one. Horse gave John a hand down onto the ice. The cold hit him in the teeth like a fist. A line of fires burned along the top of the wall, contained in iron baskets on poles taller than a man. The cold knife of the wind stirred and swirled the flames, so the lurid orange light was always shifting. Bundles of quarrels, arrows, spears, and scorpion bolts stood ready on every hand. Rocks were piled 10 feet high. Big wooden barrels of pitch and lamp oil lined up beside them. Bowen Marsh had left Castle Black well supplied in everything save men. The wind was whipping at the black cloaks of the scarecrow sentinels who stood along the ramparts, spears in hand. "I hope it wasn't one of them who blew the horn," John said to Donald Noy, when he limped up beside him.
"Did you hear that?"
Noy asked. There was the wind and horses and something else. "A mammoth," John said. "That was a mammoth." The armorer's breath was frosting as it blew from his broad, flat nose. North of the wall was a sea of darkness that seemed to stretch forever. John could make out the faint red glimmer of distant fires moving through the wood. It was Mance, certain as sunrise. The others did not light torches.
"How do we fight them if we can't see them?" Horse asked.
Donald Noy turned toward the 2 great trebuchets that Bowen Marsh had restored to working order.
"Give me light," he roared.
Barrels of pitch were loaded hastily into the slings and set afire with a torch. The wind fanned the flames to a brisk red fury.
"Now!"
Noy bellowed. The counterweights plunged downward, the throwing arms rose to thud against the padded crossbars. The burning pitch went tumbling through the darkness, casting an eerie flickering light upon the ground below. John caught a glimpse of mammoths moving ponderously through the half-light, and just as quickly lost them again. 12, maybe more. The barrel struck the earth and burst. They heard a deep bass trumpeting, and a giant roared something in the old tongue, his voice an ancient thunder that sent shivers up John's spine.
"Again!"
Noy shouted, and the trebuchets were loaded once more. 2 more barrels of burning pitch went crackling through the gloom to come crashing down amongst the foe. This time one of them struck a dead tree, enveloping it in flame. "Not 12 mammoths, John saw. 100. He stepped to the edge of the precipice. "Careful," he reminded himself. "It's a long way down." Red Allen sounded his sentry horn once more. "Ahoo! Ahoo!" Another wildlings answered, not with 1 horn, but with 12, and with drums and pipes as well. "We are come," they seemed to say. "We are come to break your war, to take your lands and steal your daughters." The wind howled, the trebuchets creaked and thumped, the barrels flew. Behind the giants and the mammoths, John saw men advancing on the wall with bows and axes. Were there 20 or 20,000? In the dark, there was no way to tell. This is a battle of blind men, but Mance has a few thousand more of them than we do.
The gate! Pip cried out. They're at the gate!
The wall was too big to be stormed by any conventional means, too high for ladders or siege towers, too thick for battering rams. No catapult could throw a stone large enough to breach it. And if you tried to set it on fire, the ice melt would quench the flames. You could climb over, as the raiders did near Greyguard, but only if you were strong and fit and sure-handed, and even then you might end up like Jarl, impaled on a tree. They must take the gate, or they cannot pass. But the gate was a crooked tunnel through the ice, smaller than any castle gate in the Seven Kingdoms, so narrow that rangers must lead their garrons through single file. Three iron gates closed the inner passage, each locked and chained and protected by a murder hole. The outer door was old oak, 9 inches thick and studded with iron, not easy to break through. But Mance has mammoths, he reminded himself, and giants as well.
Must be cold down there, said Noy. What say we warm them up, lads?
A dozen jars of lamp oil had been lined up on the precipice. Pip ran down the line with a torch, setting them alight. Owen the Oaf followed, shoving them over the edge one by one. Tongues of pale yellow fire swirled around the jars as they plunged downward. When the last was gone, Gren kicked loose the chucks on a barrel of pitch and sent it rumbling and rolling over the edge as well. The sounds below changed to shouts and screams, sweet music to their ears. Yet still the drums beat on. The trebuchets shuddered and thumped, and the sound of skin pipes came wafting through the night like the songs of strange, fierce birds. Septon Celador began to sing as well, his voice tremulous and thick with wine.
Gentle mother, font of mercy, save our sons from war, we pray. Stay the swords and stay the arrows, let them know.
Donal Noy rounded on him.
Any man who stays his sword, I'll chuck his pocket ass right off this wall. Starting with you, Septon. Archers? Do we have any bloody archers?
Here, said Satin.
And here, said Molly. But how can I find a target as black as the inside of a pig's belly? Where are they?
Noy pointed north.
Loose enough arrows. Might be you'll find a few. At least you'll make them fretful.
He looked around the ring of firelit faces.
I need 2 bows and 2 spears to help me hold the tunnel if they break the gate.
More than 10 stepped forward, and the smith picked his 4.
John, you have the wall till I return.
For a moment, John thought he'd misheard. It had sounded as if Noy were leaving him in command. My lord?
Lord, I'm a blacksmith. I said the wall is yours.
There are older men, John wanted to say, better men. I'm still as green as summer grass. I'm wounded, and I stand accused of desertion. His mouth had gone bone dry.
I,
he managed. Afterward, it would seem to Jon Snow as if he'd dreamt that night. Side by side with straw soldiers, with longbows or crossbows clutched in half-frozen hands, his archers launched 100 flights of arrows against men they never saw. From time to time, a wilding arrow came flying back in answer. He sent men to the smaller catapults and filled the air with jagged rocks the size of a giant's fist, but the darkness swallowed them as a man might swallow a handful of nuts. Mammoths trumpeted in the gloom. Strange voices called out in stranger tongues. And Septon Celador prayed so loudly and drunkenly for the dawn to come that John was tempted to chuck him over the edge himself. They heard a mammoth dying at their feet,
and saw another lurch burning through the woods, trampling down men and trees alike. The wind blew cold and colder. Hub rode up the chain with cups of onion broth, and Owen and Clydus served them to the archers where they stood, so they could gulp them down between arrows. Zay took a place among them with her crossbow. Hours of repeated jars and shocks knocked something loose on the right-hand trebuchet, and its counterweight came crashing free, suddenly and catastrophically wrenching the throwing arm sideways with a splintering crash. The left-hand trebuchet kept throwing, but the wildlings had quickly learned to shun the place where its loads were landing. "We should have 20 trebuchets, not 2, and they should be mounted on sledges and turntables so we could move them." It was a futile thought. He might as well wish for another 1,000 men, and maybe a dragon or 3. Donal Noy did not return, nor any of them who'd gone down with him to hold that black coal tunnel. "The wall is mine," John reminded himself whenever he felt his strength flagging. He'd taken up a longbow himself, and his fingers felt crabbed and stiff, half frozen. His fever was back as well, and his leg would tremble uncontrollably, sending a white-hot knife of pain right through him. "One more arrow, and I'll rest," he told himself, 50 times. "Just one more." Whenever his quiver was empty, one of the orphan moles would bring him another. "One more quiver, and I'm done." It couldn't be long until the dawn. When morning came, none of them quite realized it at first. The world was still dark, but the black had turned to grey, and shapes were beginning to emerge, half seen from the gloom. John lowered his bow to stare at the mass of heavy clouds that covered the eastern sky. He could see a glow behind them, but perhaps he was only dreaming. He notched another arrow. Then the rising sun broke through to send pale lances of light across the battleground. John found himself holding his breath as he looked out over the half-mile swathe of cleared land that lay between the wall and the edge of the forest. In half a night, they had turned it into a wasteland of blackened grass, bubbling pitch, shattered stone, and corpses. The carcass of the burned mammoth was already drawing crows. There were giants dead on the ground as well. But behind them, someone moaned to his left, and he heard Septon Celador say, "Mother, have mercy, mother, have mercy." Beneath the trees were all the wildlings in the world, raiders and giants, wargs and skin changers, mountain men, salt sea sailors, ice river cannibals, cave dwellers with dyed faces, dog chariots from the frozen shore, hornfoot men with their souls like boiled leather, all the queer wild folk Mance had gathered to break the wall. "This is not your land," John wanted to shout at them. "There is no place for you here. Go away." He could hear Tormund Giantsbane laughing at that. "You know nothing, Jon Snow," Ygritte would have said. He flexed his sword hand, opening and closing the fingers, though he knew full well that swords would not come into it up here. He was chilled and feverish, and suddenly the weight of the longbow was too much. The battle with the Magnar had been nothing, he realized, and the night fires less than nothing, only a probe, a dagger in the dark to try and catch them unprepared. The real battle was only now beginning. "I never knew there'd be so many," Satin said. John had. He'd seen them before, but not like this, not drawn up in battle array. On the march, the wildling column had sprawled over long leagues like some enormous worm, but you never saw all of it at once. But now... "Here they come," said someone in a hoarse voice. Mammoth centered the wildling line he saw, 100 or more, with giants on their backs, clutching mauls and huge stone axes. More giants loped beside them, pushing along a tree trunk on great wooden wheels, its ends sharpened to a point. A ram, he thought bleakly. if the gate still stood below, a few kisses from that thing would soon turn it into splinters. On either side of the giants came a wave of horsemen in boiled leather harness with fire-hardened lances, a mass of running archers, hundreds of foot, with spears, slings, clubs, and leathern shields. The bone chariots from the frozen shore clattered forward on the flanks, bouncing over rocks and roots behind teams of huge white dogs. The fury of the wild, John thought, as he listened to the skirl of skins, to the dogs barking and baying, the mammoths trumpeting, the free folk whistling and screaming, the giants roaring in the old tongue. Their drums echoed off the ice like rolling thunder. He could feel the despair all around him. "There must be 100,000, Saturn wailed. "How can we stop so many?" "The wall will stop them," John heard himself say. He turned and said it again louder. "The wall will stop them. The wall defends itself." Hollow words, but he needed to say them, almost as much as his brothers needed to hear them. "Mance wants to unman us with his numbers. Does he think we're stupid?" He was shouting now, his leg forgotten, and every man was listening. "The chariots, the horsemen, all those fools on foot, what are they going to do to us up here? Any of you ever seen a mammoth climb a wall?" He laughed, and Pip and Owen and half a dozen more laughed with him. "They're nothing. They're less use than our straw brothers here. They can't reach us, they can't hurt us, and they don't frighten us, do they?" "No!" Gren shouted. "They're down there, and we're up here," John said, "and so long as we hold the gate, they cannot pass. They cannot pass." They were all shouting then, roaring his own words back at him, waving swords and longbows in the air as their cheeks flushed red. John saw Keggs standing there with a warhorn slung beneath his arm. "Brother," he told him, "sound for battle." Grinning, Keggs lifted the horn to his lips and blew the two long blasts that meant wildlings. Other horns took up the call until the wall itself seemed to shudder, and the echo of those great, deep-throated moans drowned all other sound. "Archers," John said, when the horns had died away, "you aim for the giants with that ram, every bloody one of you, loose at my command, not before. The giants and the ram. I want arrows raining on them with every step, but we'll wait till they're in range. Any man who wastes an arrow will need to climb down and fetch it back. Do you hear me?"
"I do," shouted Owen the Oaf. "I hear you, Lord Snow."
John laughed like a drunk or a madman, and his men laughed with him. The chariots and the racing horsemen on the flanks were well ahead of the centre now, he saw. The wildlings had not crossed a third of the half mile, yet their battle line was dissolving. "Load the trebuchet with caltrops," John said. "Owen, Keggs, angle the catapults toward the centre. Scorpions, load with fire spears and loose at my command." He pointed at the Molestown boys. You and you, stand by with torches." The wildling archers shot as they advanced. They would dash forward, stop, loose, then run another 10 yards. There were so many that the air was constantly full of arrows, all falling woefully short. A waste, John thought. Their want of discipline is showing. The smaller horn and wood bows of the free folk were outranged by the great yew longbows of the Night's Watch, and the wildlings were trying to shoot at men 700 feet above them. "Let them shoot," John said. "Wait! Hold!" Their cloaks were flapping behind them. "The wind is in our faces. It will cost us range. Wait!" Closer, closer. The skins wailed, the drums thundered, the wildling arrows fluttered and fell. "Draw!" John lifted his own bow and pulled the arrow to his ear. Satin did the same. And Gren, Owen the Oaf, Spareboot, Blackjack Bulwer, Aaron, and Emric. Zay hoisted her crossbow to her shoulder. John was watching the ram come on and on, the mammoths and giants lumbering forward on either side. They were so small, he could have crushed them all in one hand, it seemed. If only my hand was big enough. Through the killing ground they came. 100 crows rose from the carcass of the dead mammoth as the wildlings thundered past to either side of them. Closer and closer, until loose! The black arrows hissed downward like snakes on feathered wings. John did not wait to see where they struck. He reached for a second arrow as soon as the first left his bow. Notch, draw, loose! As soon as the arrow flew, he found another. Notch, draw, loose! Again and then again. John shouted for the trebuchet and heard the creak and heavy thud as 100 spike steel caltrops went spinning through the air. Catapults, he called. Scorpions, bowmen, loose at will. Wildling arrows were striking the wall now, 100 feet below them. A second giant spun and staggered. Notch, draw, loose. A mammoth veered into another beside it, spilling giants on the ground. Notch, draw, loose. The ram was down and done, he saw. The giants who'd pushed it, dead or dying. Fire arrows, he shouted. I want that ram burning. The screams of wounded mammoths and the booming cries of giants mingled with the drums and pipes to make an awful music, yet still his archers drew and loosed, as if they'd all gone as deaf as dead Dick Follard. They might be the dregs of the Order, but they were men of the Night's Watch, or near enough as made no matter. That's why they shall not pass. One of the mammoths was running berserk, smashing wildlings with his trunk and crushing archers underfoot. John pulled back his bow once more and launched another arrow at the beast's shaggy back to urge him on. To east and west, the flanks of the wildling host had reached the wall unopposed. Their chariots drew in or turned, while the horsemen milled aimlessly beneath the looming cliff of ice. At the gate, a shout came. Spare boot, maybe. Mammoth at the gate! Fire! John barked. Gren! Pip! Gren thrust his bow aside, wrestled a barrel of oil onto its side, and rolled it to the edge of the wall, where Pip hammered out the plug that sealed it, stuffed in a twist of cloth, set it alight with a torch. They shoved it over together. 100 feet below, it struck the wall and burst, filling the air with shattered staves and burning oil. Gren was rolling a second barrel to the precipice by then, and Keggs had one as well. Pip lit them both. Got him, Satin shouted, his head sticking out so far that John was certain he was about to fall. Got him, got him, got him! He could hear the roar of fire. A flaming giant lurched into view, stumbling and rolling on the ground. Then suddenly the mammoths were fleeing, running from the smoke and flames and smashing into those behind them in their terror. Those went backward too, the giants and wildlings behind them scrambling to get out of their way. In half a heartbeat, the whole center was collapsing. The horsemen on the flanks saw themselves being abandoned and decided to fall back as well, not one so much as blooded. Even the chariots rumbled off, having done nothing but look fearsome and make a lot of noise. When they break hard, Jon Snow thought, as he watched them reel away. The drums had all gone silent. How'd you like that music, Mance? How'd you like the taste of the Dornishman's wife? Do we have anyone hurt? He asked. The bloody bugger's got my leg. Spareboot plucked the arrow out and waved it above his head. The wooden one! A ragged cheer went up. Zay grabbed Owen by the hands, spun him around in a circle, and gave him a long, wet kiss right there for all to see. She tried to kiss John, too, but he held her by the shoulder and pushed her gently but firmly away. No, he said, I am done with kissing. Suddenly, he was too weary to stand. and his leg was agony from knee to groin. He fumbled for his crutch. "Pip, help me to the cage. Gren, you have the wall."
"Me?" said Gren. "Em?" said Pip.
It was hard to tell which of them was more horrified.
"But,"
Gren stammered,
but what do I do if the wildlings attack again?"
"Stop them," John told him. As they rode down in the cage, Pip took off his helm and wiped his brow.
"Frozen sweat. Is there anything as disgusting as frozen sweat?"
He laughed.
"God, I don't think I've ever been so hungry. I could eat an oryx whole, I swear it. Do you think Hub will cook up Gren for us?"
When he saw John's face, his smile died.
"What's wrong? Is it your leg?"
"My leg," John agreed. Even the words were an effort.
"Not the battle, though. We won the battle."
"Ask me when I've seen the gate," John said grimly. "I want a fire, a hot meal, a warm bed, and something to make my leg stop hurting," he told himself. But first he had to check the tunnel and find what had become of Donal Noy. After the battle with the Thens, it had taken them almost a day to clear the ice and broken beams away from the inner gate. Spotted Pate and Keggs and some of the other builders had argued heatedly that they ought just to leave the debris there, another obstacle for Mance. That would have meant abandoning the defence of the tunnel, though, and Noy was having none of it. With men in the murder holes and archers and spears behind each inner grate, a few determined brothers could hold off 100 times as many wildlings and clog the way with corpses. He did not mean to give Mance Rayder free passage through the ice. So with pick and spade and ropes, they had moved the broken steps aside and dug back down to the gate. John waited by the cold iron bars while Pip went to Maester Aemon for the spare key. Surprisingly, the maester himself returned with him, and Clydus with a lantern.
"Come see me when we are done,"
the old man told John while Pip was fumbling with the chains.
"I need to change your dressing and apply a fresh poultice, and you will want some more dream wine for the pain."
John nodded weakly. The door swung open. Pip led them in, followed by Clydus and the lantern. It was all John could do to keep up with Maester Aemon. The ice pressed close around them, and he could feel the cold seeping into his bones, the weight of the wall above his head. It felt like walking down the gullet of an ice dragon. The tunnel took a twist and then another. Pip unlocked a second iron gate. They walked farther, turned again, and saw a light ahead, faint and pale through the ice. "That's bad," John knew at once. "That's very bad." Then Pip said,
"There's blood on the floor."
The last 20 feet of the tunnel was where they'd fought and died. The outer door of studded oak had been hacked and broken and finally torn off its hinges, and one of the giants had crawled in through the splinters. The lantern bathed the grisly scene in a sullen reddish light. Pip turned aside to Retch, and John found himself envying Maester Aemon his blindness. Noy and his men had been waiting within, behind a gate of heavy iron bars like the two Pip had just unlocked. The two crossbows had gotten off a dozen quarrels as the giant struggled toward them. Then the spearman must have come to the fore, stabbing through the bars. Still, the giant found the strength to reach through, twist the head off Spotted Pate, seize the iron gate, and wrench the bars apart. Links of broken chain lay strewn across the floor. One giant. All this was the work of one giant.
"Are they all dead?"
Maester Aemon asked softly. "Yes." Donal was the last. Noy's sword was sunk deep into the giant's throat, halfway to the hilt. The armourer had always seemed such a big man to John, but locked in the giant's massive arms, he looked almost like a child. The giant crushed his spine. I don't know who died first. He took the lantern and moved forward for a better look. Meg, I am the last of the giants. He could feel the sadness there, but he had no time for sadness. It was Meg the Mighty, the king of the giants. He needed sun then. It was too cold and dark inside the tunnel, and the stench of blood and death was suffocating. John gave the lantern back to Clytus, squeezed around the bodies and through the twisted bars, and walked toward the daylight to see what lay beyond the splintered door. The huge carcass of a dead mammoth partially blocked the way. One of the beast's tusks snagged his cloak and tore it as he edged past. Three more giants lay outside, half buried beneath stone and slush and hardened pitch. He could see where the fire had melted the wall, where great sheets of ice had come sloughing off in the heat to shatter on the blackened ground. He looked up at where they'd come from. When you stand here, it seems immense, as if it were about to crush you. John went back inside to where the others waited. We need to repair the outer gate as best we can, and then block up this section of the tunnel. Rubble, chunks of ice, anything. All the way to the second gate, if we can. Sir Winton will need to take command. He's the last knight left. But he needs to move now. The giants will be back before we know it. We have to tell him...
Tell him what you will, said Maester Aemon gently. He will smile, nod, and forget. 30 years ago, Sir Winton Stout came within a dozen votes of being Lord Commander. He would have made a fine one. 10 years ago, he would still have been capable. No longer. You know that as well as Donald did, John.
It was true. You give the order, then, John told the maester. You have been on the wall your whole life. The men will follow you. We have to close the gate.
I am a maester, trained and sworn. My order serves, John. We give counsel, not commands.
Someone must.
You must lead.
No.
Yes, John. It need not be for long. Only until such time as the garrison returns. Donald chose you and Corran Halfhand before him. Lord Commander Mormont made you his steward. You are a son of Winterfell, a nephew of Benjen Stark. It must be you or no one. The wall is yours, Jon Snow.